Now we were looking yesterday at C, capital C, the life of George Whitefield. And under that, number one, early life, we've already discussed his early life. Number two, the Holy Club. We noticed this group in Oxford of very earnest, diligent men, and how Whitefield became associated with him, with them, and what help they were to him. Then number three, conversion and first preaching. We spoke yesterday about his conversion. It was through this book of Henry, this book of this Scotch divine whom we discussed yesterday, whose book on the life of God in the soul of man brought this burst of light to Whitefield, yes? No. The word pietist, in the most general sense, means anyone who is really interested in a relation to God, not simply in knowing some doctrine. And in that sense, it certainly was pietistic. But the term pietistic is generally used in connection with the movement that began in Europe and that centered in Halle in Germany. And this had no connection with that, whatever. This was connected with the Scotch, continuing Scotch Presbyterian Covenanter tradition that came from John Knox. And it was a book written shortly after the end of the killing time in Scotland. Now, this book, which was given to him by Charles Wesley in order to help him in his spiritual difficulties, was the book through which he received a peace of heart. The other men in the Holy Club didn't seem to have the need of peace of heart that he did at this time. Whitefield felt very keenly aware of his sin and of his need of a real knowledge of Christ as Savior, a personal knowledge of Him as Savior, and he found the answer in this book, which pointed to justification by faith and to a direct relation with Christ. Now, the other members of the Holy Club, while later they came to experience this feeling of need, at this time give little indication of anything of that sort. They were good, earnest men who were seeking to win their way to heaven by performing the sacraments of the church regularly, by doing, having prayer many times a day, special seasons of prayer and regular observances, getting up early in the morning in order to go through the prayer book and spending a great deal of time going helping the poor, going to the hospitals and the jails, trying to help people. And they were extremely unpopular in Oxford. Not so much for their religions, because everyone in Oxford had to be nominally a member of the Church of England in order to be allowed to attend the university at all at that time. People looked on them as crazy fanatics and ridiculed them. But the thing that made them most angry was their going to the hospitals and to the jails and trying to help people. That was what they were most attacked and criticized for by the other students in the general ungodly atmosphere of Oxford. I think it's a very good illustration of the fact that the so-called social gospel does not flourish apart from the real gospel, which originates interest in the welfare of other people. It is a descendant of it, you might say. But when it is divorced from it, it soon loses its power to accomplish good. Yes?
Did you say yesterday that they were not Calvinists?
I said yesterday that Whitefield was a very strong Calvinist, that these other men were very loyal followers of the Church of England. And the creed of the Church of England is a Calvinistic creed, but it is not outspokenly Calvin. And under Charles I, the leading officials in the Church of England had definitely taken a position opposed to Calvinistic attitudes and insisted that the creed must be interpreted in that way. Now, if you read the creed as it stands, it is much more natural to interpret it as Calvinistic than as anti-Calvinistic. But it is not a strongly stated on these particular points. And these men were loyal followers of the Church of England who were following its teaching and not particularly trying to examine details, but trying to work out in their life what they felt the precepts of the Church of England called for. And so Whitfield had this experience coming from this book that Charles Wesley gave him, this book by this Scottish divine. But of course, also related to the fact that he had had such a great feeling of need. And even after he read the book, he did not get the answer immediately. There were many weeks that passed after, during which he tried all sorts of things, like fasting to such an extent that he hurt his health, that he was ill for a time. And he tried all sorts of things, trying to find peace with God. And then he returned to what he had found in this book, and decision came to him, the understanding came to him, that through the grace of God, and that alone, he, an utterly unworthy sinner, could find his full forgiveness with God and fellowship and communion with Christ. And from that time on, he never wavered. From that time on, he was always praising God for the wonderful gift of salvation God had given him. And the great object of his life from that time on was to bring the knowledge of this salvation to other people. And there probably has never been a person in history who has been more used of God to reach others for salvation through Christ than George Whitfield was. His life from this time was a constant effort for this objective. Now, he was only 21 at this time. And he finished his work at Oxford, came back to his home in Gloucester, and the Bishop of Gloucester, who seems to have been a very fine man, was very much oppressed with the young man, and he had a very definite rule against ordaining anyone before they were 22 years of age. But he made an exception in the case of Whitfield, and on the bishop's own suggestion, he ordained him as a deacon. In the Church of England, the ordination was first as a deacon, and then later one would be moved up to the position of a full ordination as a priest. But he ordained him as a deacon of the Church of England and invited him to preach in one of the large churches there. And when the word got around that this man who used to serve drinks in the hotel there, and who was known to so many of the young people there, and who had been active as a young man in the little plays that they acted, and that sort of thing, that he was going to preach in the church was filled. And he preached a great sermon on salvation there in the church, which made a very great impression there. And then for some months he preached in different parts of England, and he was welcomed in all the churches. He had, as a young man, been greatly interested in dramatics, and he had studied dramatics very considerably and had practiced performing the different parts in the plays as a young man. He never did any more of this after this time. But there was something tremendously dramatic about Whitfield's manners of preaching. His constant emphasis was on the sinner's lost condition, the fact that only through the grace of God could he be saved, and the call to Christ to receive salvation. And then he was constantly picturing the eternity of misery as contrasted with the eternity of blessing to those who are in Christ. And these were the great central aspects of his preaching, which he constantly presented, but in new forms. He prepared his sermons with great care. It was strictly forbidden in the Church of England at this time to preach anything that was not written down carefully first. And Whitfield prepared his sermons with tremendous care. Every word was carefully worked out. But when he gave them, you had no least feeling of his reading. There was a great vividness and directness to it, with the result that when he went up to London to preach in one of the churches, the second time he preached there, a great crowd was there, and he was invited to preach in other churches, and during a period of time, he preached in a number of churches in London, with great crowds coming to hear him in these churches. And people said there's a great future ahead in the church for this young man who has such a tremendous ability as a preacher. But Whitfield wasn't interested in a great future. He was interested in serving the Lord. He was interested in winning souls to Christ. And his friends in the Holy Club, he was very intimate with, and he began to receive letters from two of his friends, at whose lives we will look more in detail later, because they are of tremendous importance in the history of the Christian church. But now we're interested in their relation to Whitfield. And these two were John Wesley, who was 11 years older than he was, and Charles Wesley, who was about 6 years older than he was. John Wesley had been the founder of the Holy Club, and Charles Wesley, his younger brother, had been in the direction of the Holy Club, the leadership, while John had been back at his home in Epworth, helping his father in the church there, where his father had been rector for many years. Then John had returned to Oxford and had a position on in the university there, and was still active in the Holy Club, and so Whitfield had become very intimate with them. And these three men, to the end of their lives, were very, very close friends. No one of the three considered anybody else in the world as good a friend of his as he did the other two of this group of three. But these two men had gone to America. Charles and John had, John first, had become interested in the Indians in America. He had heard about the Indians over here and their need of salvation, need of the knowledge of Christ, and General Oglethorpe, the founder of the colony of Georgia, had brought back to England an Indian chief and some Indians with him, and they had spoken around in London, different places, and made a great impression. And this was a period in Europe when people were beginning to think about the noble savage, people untainted by civilization, and the wonderful noble characters that people naturally have before they get corrupted by civilization, and how wonderful it would be to go to these people and tell them about Christ and bring them the gospel. And Wycliffe, Wesley, became tremendously attracted by this idea, and he wrote his father. He had written his father before how he was hoping that his soul would be saved with all the hard work he was doing in Oxford there, preaching to these holding these prayer meetings and working for the poor and carrying on these regular devotions. His father felt that he had a little too much interest in the feeling that he was doing this for his own good, for his own salvation, rather than for the good that he was doing for the people he was reaching with him. But now he wrote to his father and he said, how can I expect the Lord's merit, the Lord's favor, if I stay in the easy life of England? Of course, to us today, it would seem like a very primitive lifestyle. But compared to America in those days, it was very cultured and very mature compared to the wild country over here at that time. Wesley said, here I can go and I can bring the gospel to these noble savages. And he said, that's the way that I will truly win the favor of God. And so John Wesley had come to America, and Charles Wesley, his brother, had gotten a position as secretary to the governor. So the two had come over to America. And from America, they wrote letters to Whitfield. And they said to Whitfield, we need your help over here. They said, there's a tremendous opportunity here. There's a great field here. Why do you stay with these people in England? They've had religion all their lives. They've heard all these things. Come over here where you need it. And Whitfield decided he would do so. And so he turned down the opportunities of great pulpits and great outreach, which he could have so easily because as a speaker, he was perhaps naturally the finest speaker in all England. Probably never been a greater natural speaker in history than Whitfield was. But he turned it all down in order to come over to America and made arrangements to leave there and got on a boat which took 6 days going down the coast before it started the 9 weeks trip across the ocean. And just before they were to leave, John Wesley got back to England and wrote a letter which reached Whitfield in the boat and said, don't go over there, you can't accomplish anything there. The people are hardened over there and uninterested in Christianity, and the Indians simply can't be reached at all, and it's very foolish to waste your time on that. You should stay in England. But Whitfield was already on the boat, ready to start for America, and he came along. And we will look later at the very sad experience that John Wesley had in Georgia, where he had worked so hard and tried so hard to do good. But everything he did was misinterpreted. When he asked the Indians to come and get religious instruction, they said, we have a few wars to fight with these other tribes around. When we get through with our fighting, then we'll be ready maybe to come and listen to you. And he decided that the Indians were interested in nothing but fighting. And the governor said, you better work in the colony here. You don't have much chance among the Indians. And then he worked very hard in the colony and very conscientiously. And nobody appreciated what he did. He became very interested in a young woman. And when he was sick for a week, she nursed him in his sickness. And she began dressing very demurely and taking great interest in the church. And then he thought that he would ask her to marry him. And then a friend of his said, well, now, don't you think you ought to stop and consider whether she's the one you ought to marry? And ask these Moravian elders. They've got a lot of wisdom. And so he asked them and a couple of friends, and they said, no, we don't think she's the right one for you to marry. And so he just quit paying any attention to her. And when he did this, she then, within just a few days, she married somebody else. And he, as the director of the church and the head of the religious work there, decided that in running off and marrying this man she hardly knew, she was breaking the principles of what sound life for a member of the church, and disciplined her as head of the church. And then her relatives immediately brought a suit against him for defamation of character. And he was acquitted in the suit, but it was a very miserable situation and experience. And after a few months in Georgia, he went back to England, totally disillusioned about any effective work over here. And so he had written, and Charles had written, and their letters had led Whitfield to decide to come to Georgia to do the work. But when he got here, neither of them was here anymore. But now we go on to his trip, number 4, Voyage to America. And of all the interesting stories of from a viewpoint of church history of a trip on the ocean that ever were, I don't think there's any more so than this account of Whitfield's visit to America. Whitfield's first voyage, he made 13 trips across the ocean. He spent over 2 years altogether on the ocean in the course of his life. But in this, his first trip, he was on the boat and he found that the sailors were all given the cursing and swearing, and there was, while there were regular services that had to be performed, and he as an ordained man could perform the regular service once a week. Otherwise, people had no interest in Christianity and felt that this minister here was sort of a nuisance to have on the boat. But Whitfield went around, young fellow, just 22 years of age at this time. He went around among the sailors, talking to each of them about the Lord. And he'd go up on the bridge and talk to the first mate. And he would talk to all these different people whenever he could. And he got a few of them interested and got a few of them to come to a special meeting that he held for them. And then he met with one of the leading gentlemen on the boat. I'm not sure whether he was the captain or one of the leaders anyway. And he had coffee with him and he said, now I'm having services for these sailors, don't you think we ought to have something that the passengers and the gentlemen on the boat could attend? And the fellow says, well, he says, if you want to have some, I guess there's no objection. But he says, I'm not sure many of us will come to it. But anyway, they let him do it. So he started holding services. And day and night, whenever he wasn't actually sleeping or studying, he was busy talking to people about the Lord. And he began holding these services. And in the course of the 9 weeks, there was a complete change in the attitude on the boat. Person after person, both among the officers and the leaders and among the sailors, were led to the Lord. The cursing stopped. The whole attitude of the boat changed. They would hold services every day, and they would have him climb up at the lower part of the sails of the place a person could stand where they all could see him. And everybody would crowd around, and he would preach to them. And there were two other boats crossing with it. They were sending a group of soldiers over to America, and these three boats were going together. And the other boats would sometimes be near enough that they could hear the preaching, and they could hear the sermons in the other boat. And then from the other boats, they said, why can't he come over and give us a sermon? And so they took the little boat and carried him across to one of the other ships, and he held services on the three ships. And there were a great many conversions on the boat. And he, when they finally were about to land, they had a big farewell service And many of the people were just weeping the thought that they had to part from him with the tremendous influence he had had and the changes he'd made in the lives, or that the Lord had made through him in the lives of so many people there. And in many cases, the changes made a complete change in their whole life, which left. Yes? He was a deacon, yes. His ordination was that of a deacon. Then he got to America, and in Georgia, he began to, his sermons were well received. He went to visit the Salzburgers, the people who had been driven out of Salzburg, some of whom had come to Georgia and had a colony there. He went out there and visited them, was much impressed with their work, and he went out where there was a group of Moravians. And these Moravians had, some of them been on the boat with John Wesley when he had come across. And he visited there, and he was much impressed with them. And these Moravians had established an orphanage, like the orphanages in Halle, in Germany, which the Pietists had erected there. And Whitfield was much impressed with the work among the children in the orphanage. And he said, why can't we establish an orphanage among the English colonies? And so he set to work to get people to start an orphanage. And in order to carry it on, they needed money. And so he decided to go back to England to raise some money to carry on the work there. Now, Whitfield had been writing a journal in which he described his experiences. And especially on the boat going over, he described day by day what had happened, and it's really sort of like Augustine's confession. He is praying to the Lord to bless his work and to help him to reach the people for the Lord. And he's praising the Lord in the case of each individual that comes to Christ and each opportunity that he has to preach. And he sent, mailed the journal to a friend in England, and the friend read it and was so impressed by it that he got it printed. And so it was distributed in England, and all the church leaders were horrified. And the result was that when Whitfield got back to England, he found that all the churches where he'd been a welcome visitor were closed to him. There were hardly any churches where they were willing to have him preach. And they simply said, well, this book, this journal shows such enthusiasm. We don't want enthusiasm. We want sober Christian piety. We don't want enthusiasm. We don't want excitement like this. We don't want anything of this sort. And they were down on it. And there were very few that would let him preach. And so, number five, I call innovations in England. Innovations in England. By this time, John Wesley and Charles Wesley had both had experiences which brought their viewpoint in life in line with that which Whitfield had received previous to this time, before going to America. I shouldn't say their viewpoint, because they both were very earnest, loyal followers of the Church of England. But and they had no thought of making any alteration in the doctrine or the procedures of the Church of England. But they had, each of them, had an experience which had led them to cease looking to their own good work for salvation, and had led them to see that it's only through the grace of God that they could receive the Lord's blessing. I think we might, though we'll speak more at length about them later, of course, we might take a minute on how they received this experience. John Wesley, on his way over, I mentioned the connection with the Moravians, how he was going across to Georgia in the first place, when they had a great storm, and many of the people were so frightened, and toward the end of the storm, a great wave poured over the ship, and it looked as if it might just wreck the ship. People were just crying out in fear and in agony, but here were the Moravians smiling and seemingly unconcerned with it. And Wesley asked them, he said, how can you be so unconcerned? You might be swept into eternity. They said, well, if we are, we just go to be with the Lord, which is far better. And they were so happy, they had a happiness in their attitude that he hadn't seen among any of his associates. And he set to work to learn German in order to get to know them better. And then on the way back, he had some contact with the Moravians, and in England there, he had gone to their chapel, to their services quite a bit. And one day, in one of their meetings, somebody read a translation of the preface of Luther's preface to his commentary on the Book of Romans. And as Wesley heard how Luther presented salvation by faith alone, without being saved on the merit of anything one had done himself, as he listened to this, he said he felt his heart strangely warmed, and he counted his conversion from that point. He insisted that he had not even been a Christian before that time, that he had become a Christian now, being converted through hearing this writing of Luther. Now, before John Wesley had this experience, shortly before, Charles Wesley had a similar experience, this time through reading the preface to Luther's commentary on Galatians. So in the case of both of the Wesleys, what they considered to be their conversion was the result of reading Luther's writings and of passing on to them of the experiences that Luther had had himself in finding the knowledge of salvation by faith. While in Whitfield's case, it had been a book given him by Charles Wesley, but a book passing on the experience from Scotland of these who were following in the footsteps of John Knox. But now, Whitfield went to see the Bishop of Gloucester, who had ordained him a deacon, and he now ordained him a priest. And this bishop allowed him to preach in his church. But most of the English churches were closed to Whitfield, and the Wesleys felt that if the church won't let you preach in it, well, we must hope and pray that some change can be made. We will be allowed to preach in the church. But Whitfield said, if I can't preach in the church, he said, why can't I go outdoors and preach? Well, that's definitely contrary to the rules of the church. And no one but an ordained person is supposed to preach. He's not supposed to preach anything, at least at that time he was not, unless it was written out, carefully worded, and he was not to pray extempore. He was to read a prayer, and he certainly was not to hold a service outside of the consecrated building. But Whitfield went out and began to preach outside, and people began to come to hear him. And then Whitfield heard about the coal miners, who had been utterly neglected by the church. And he went to a place some distance away where there were a great many coal miners who had been utterly neglected, who were, as he said, as heathen as anyone you'd find anywhere, knew nothing about Christianity, had no contact with it. They were living lives of drunkenness and swearing and of all kinds of sin, and utterly neglected. And Whitfield said, we ought to bring the message of salvation to these people. He went up to there where they were, and he went out and began to preach, and gathered a group of a few hundred, and before long he had 2,000 people listening to him there. And then he came to a place where they had hangings, and at that time hanging was a penalty for a great many crimes. And so there were even bodies still hanging, disintegrating, around on the gibbets in this place. And it was a place where, except for the hangings, there were ordinarily only criminals had their headquarters there, and decent people would not hardly dare go through the place except to witness a hanging case. And he went over there, and he began, got up on a little hill and began to preach, and people began to gather, and he had many hundreds of people listening to his sermon. And they said that as the coal miners listened, the tears began to come and to go down their faces and make little white streaks in the midst of the coal dust over the faces. And John Wesley was quite shocked at what Whitfield was doing. But he came up to see him. He was very much attached to Whitfield. And he came up to see him and saw what he was doing and was impressed with the way that he was reaching these people. And then the time came when Whitfield had to go. He had promised to go back to Georgia and carry on his work. And he said, here are all these people wanting to hear the gospel. He said, now, John, he said, you preach to them. And John was 11 years older than George Whitfield was, and he had never preached outside of the church building before in his life. And he thought it was terrible, but he'd seen the good effects that came from Whitfield's preaching, and he had a heart that was burning with desire to bring to others the blessing that he had received and that Whitfield had and his brother had. And so when Whitfield urged him, he said, well, I've, I must put on my costume, be sure I have the right gown on, and so on. And to the end of his life, he wore his full costume every time he preached, almost anyone. But John Wesley took over, and while he did not have the great oratorical ability that Whitfield had, which was among the greatest the world has ever seen, he nevertheless was a very good, effective speaker, and his great seriousness and earnestness made a real appeal to these people. He followed along the line that Whitfield had started. And now Whitfield returned to America, and the Wesleys proceeded to carry on in England the type of work that Whitfield had originated there. And so you have an interaction between Whitfield and the Wesleys. And one time later on, when there was great disputing between some of Whitfield's followers and some of Wesley's followers, later on in their lives, one time somebody said to John Wesley, they said, "Wesley, do you think you will see Whitfield in heaven?" "No," he said, "I don't." He said, "You don't?" "Well, certainly not," he said. "He said, when I get to heaven," he said, "I'll be somewhere on the outskirts." And he says, "George Whitfield will have a will be standing right up near the throne. And if I get a glimpse of him, I'll be very fortunate." Which is a beautiful example of the brilliant skill in wording that Wesley possessed, and of presenting the ideas which he had, and also shows the great love there was and admiration between these men through most of their lives, though they had a few periods of separation between themselves, largely occasioned by the attitude of some of the followers of the two men, who carried some of the teachings on each side to certain extremes beyond which the leader would not have gone. But before we go on with the work in Britain, we want to look at Whitfield's return to America. And I'm going to call D the Great Awakening in America. And perhaps I should have put this earlier in the outline, because actually the Great Awakening in America began before Whitfield began his work in America. This Great Awakening in America was a movement here, a continuation of the Puritan teaching, which had never been disrupted over here the way it had been in Britain. There had been attempts made by the representatives of Charles II and James II to interfere with the Puritan stand in America, but they'd been rather half-hearted attempts, and they had not caused much disruption. The main interference that had come had been from growing worldliness and general decline religious interest, such as naturally comes anywhere unless we turn back to the Lord and determine to maintain our close relationship with Him. And over a period of here about 100 years had passed, and there had been a decline, but there were those who began to pray that God would bring a real awakening. And outstanding among them, I'll make number one under this, Jonathan Edwards. Outstanding among them was Jonathan Edwards, a very unusual combination of perhaps one of the greatest philosophical minds in modern times, a man whose philosophical writings were very highly regarded, and not only in America, but also in Europe. A man who said that he read books of philosophy with the keenest of delight, like a man who, he said, was finding gold in the mine or something, but who, along with it, also had a tremendous love for souls and a tremendous passion to make his life count for the Lord. Jonathan Edwards, after he graduated from college, went to the place where his grandfather was pastor, in Massachusetts, and he became his grandfather's assistant for 2 years. And his grandfather had, while an earnest Christian man, had given in some to the declining tendencies of the time. He was permitting people to partake of communion who gave no evidence of true conversion, and he had let down the bars in certain ways which displeased Jonathan. And after his grandfather's death, and even to some extent before, Jonathan Edwards began preaching of the terrors of the judgment of God and the wonderful love and mercy of Christ. One of his sermons was called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And when he preached it, the people were just filled with terror. And a sermon which has even been repeated sometimes in recent times. In Jonathan Edwards' sermons, there is more that is permanent, you might say, than in Whitfield's. Whitfield's sermons were good, but the great thing in Whitfield's sermons was his delivery, while the content was excellent, but perhaps not as good as Jonathan Edwards. The delivery was so outstanding that it simply was without comparison. But Jonathan Edwards had a great revival there in the area where he was, and he continued his work, became in contact with Whitfield in later years. They became very close friends, and Whitfield was a great help in this work. And eventually, Jonathan Edwards left the church and went as a missionary to the Indians a few miles north of here, and carried on the work of his son-in-law, David Brainerd, for a time there, and then was called to be, he's the first president of Princeton University. At least he's one of the very early presidents. But he was only president a few weeks when he died a martyr to science. They were trying to persuade people to adopt vaccinations for smallpox. And people were afraid of it. And smallpox was a terrible scourge then that was taking hundreds of people when there'd be an epidemic anywhere. And Jonathan Edwards, in order to encourage people to receive the vaccination for smallpox, had himself be one of the first to receive it. And in some way, evidently the vaccine they gave him wasn't very good, or something was wrong with it, because he was taken sick and died very shortly after. It saved hundreds of others, the lives of hundreds of others probably, but he died after being president a very few weeks of Princeton University. But during this time, Jonathan Edwards had been very active in Christian work and also in philosophical writings. I mentioned here his son-in-law. We'll mention his name, David Brainerd. So they call him number two, David Brainerd. It's hard to get these things in chronological order because they run along the same time, more or less. But David Brainerd was the son-in-law of Jonathan Edwards. And David Brainerd, as a student in Yale, was very much interested in the gospel and reaching people for the Lord, so much so that the faculty decided that he was too enthusiastic. And he was criticized by some of the faculty of Yale, and he told another student he didn't think a certain professor was even a Christian, and they quoted this. And when this was quoted, he was expelled from Yale University. And so he went back later to be present at the commencement a year later, but did not graduate because he was expelled for being too enthusiastic in his Christian life. But David Brainerd had a great love for the Indians and a desire to win them for the Lord. And he had spent years in missionary work among the Indians up north of here, up along in this area, not so many miles from here. And he got consumption and died quite a young man. But he wrote a journal expressing the outpourings of his love for Christ and his desire to serve him and his experiences in reaching these men. And Jonathan Edwards edited David Brainerd's journal and published it. Brainerd died before he reached the age of 30. But the journal has been used of the Lord and reprinted many times since that time to win people to a similar love to Christ. Then another man who is very important, I'll name two men here. Now I forget the name of the father, it slipped with me. But the son is Gilbert Tennant. I think the father is William, I'm not quite sure. But the older man, Mr. Tennant, was a Presbyterian from Ireland who came over to this country and who established a log college 20 miles north of Philadelphia for the training of young pastors and evangelists. And his son Gilbert was one of the leading students in the college and became one of the leaders of the movement through here for earnest evangelism and effective Christian witness. And they were very active throughout this area here. The Tennants were so active and so outspoken that people soon were either strong supporters of the tenants or great haters of the tenants. And in fact, the presbytery split for about 20 years between the new light who followed the tenants and the old light who were against them. Eventually, they rejoined after about 20 years. But Log College, which he founded, eventually was replaced by a group meeting in New Jersey, out of which Princeton University developed. So some speak of the Log College as the beginning of Princeton. Actually, I don't think it's the beginning, but it's the precursor. Princeton was established by the followers of the tenants, along with the other folks who were reunited to them by this time. It represents the combined group rather than simply theirs, though their influence was dominant in it as it stuck. But these men were carrying on a good and effective work over here, but the work was well underway, but had not nearly reached its greatest peak when Whitfield returned to America. And so, number four is Whitfield's work in America. And Whitfield, after working in Georgia for a little time longer, he was anxious to get more money and support for his orphanage, and he also was anxious to help the proclamation of the gospel in other parts of America. And so he took a trip north from Georgia, and he stopped at various places, and at first was very poorly received in many places. But eventually, he came to win the favor of almost everywhere. At first, Yale and Harvard were afraid of him, did not want him. Eventually, particularly Yale welcomed him and had him preach repeatedly to the students. In Harvard, he had considerable influence, though not as much as in Yale. Perhaps his greatest place of influence was in the Philadelphia area here. Whitfield was greatly interested in education, and he urged people in Philadelphia here to start a school. And a school was started here in Philadelphia, and at Whitfield's urging, and which went through a number of metamorphoses, changes of name and organization, but eventually developed into the University of Pennsylvania. And in, I believe, was it 1909 or 29? Sometime in this century, a large bronze statue of Whitfield preaching was put up on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania, recognizing the great part he had in the starting of that institution. Whitfield, as I mentioned, made 13 crossings of the ocean. He, in America here, he made several trips north and always returning to Georgia as his center. They said that when he would preach, his voice could be heard for about a mile. His voice was so strong if it was in decent weather. They counted sometimes as many as 20,000 people without loudspeakers listening to him preaching. When he left Boston one time, after a series of meetings there, they had a public meeting. They said 30,000 people gathered in order to hear him. I don't know how many of them could hear him, but a great many. He preached in Philadelphia here one time, and Benjamin Franklin was quite disgusted. He said, why should he take the money here from Philadelphia and carry it down to build an orphanage in Georgia? We have orphans here. Why can't they raise money here to take care of the people here? And so he said, I'm not going to give anything to the collection this time. But Franklin tells in his autobiography how, as he heard Whitfield preach, he got more and more carried away with what he said. And he says, well, he says, I'll put the loose coins in my pocket in the collection. And then Franklin says, after he went on a little further, he says, well, he says, I guess I'll put half of the money I got on in the collection. And finally, when the collection came, Franklin says, he put in everything he had with him in the collection. They say that in this area and in New England, there were tens of thousands of people who joined the Congregational and Presbyterian churches as a result of Whitfield's preaching. And many new churches were established all over the British colonies in America as a result of Whitfield's work. He made 7 trips over here. In between, he had long periods of preaching in England. With these trips here, as I said, he spent over 2 years on the boat in the course of these trips. Once or twice, the ships had serious difficulties, but the Lord brought them through safely. He always preached on the boat constantly if he could. Sometimes his health was bad, and he was unable to. But his contribution to the development of Christian life in America was a tremendous one, though he did not start the movement here. He did help tremendously in carrying it forward and left a great imprint on this country. Finally, on his last trip to America, when he was in his 50s, he was up in Massachusetts, one place, and he was in poor health, and the people came around wanting to hear him preach, and a great crowd came, and he came out in the evening from his room and stood at the head of the stairs and had the front door open so as many as possible could get there and hear him, and he held the candle in his hand, and he on something, I suppose, in his hand, and he preached until the candle burned clear down, they say, to the bottom, and then he went back and went to his room, and a few hours later he died, and they buried him there in Massachusetts. And at his request, John Wesley held a meeting in London, a farewell for him. And he felt if they had a memorial for him, he wanted John Wesley to be the one who preached it. And John Wesley fell toward him, as we've already seen. Well, so much for the Great Awakening in America. Now, Whitfield's part in England, and also the work of his associates there, has many interesting angles to it, which we could take a long time on. It was very interesting, but we'll only have time to look at a few of them. I can maybe spend a couple more minutes still in this hour. And so we'll say E, Whitfield's continuing work in Britain and America. I guess it's better to say Britain, because we already covered America. Yes? Whitfield. Whitfield's continuing work in Britain. He made these 7 trips to America. In between them, he spent fairly long periods in Britain. And when he got back there, the Wesleys were already actively preaching widely the way he had been doing, and people were coming to assist them in the work. They had other preachers joining with them. And John Wesley had a particular ability as in organizing the converts into groups to develop the spiritual life and to carry on for the Lord. And Whitfield went about England and Scotland and Wales and Ireland during the period when he was in Great Britain and preached over there a great deal. And here we should note as number one under this, Selina, Countess of Huntingdon. Selina, Countess of Huntingdon. Now this Selina, Countess of Huntingdon was a young woman of the, she was a few years older than Whitfield. She was a woman of the aristocracy, and she married the Earl of Huntingdon, who was himself one of the leaders in the aristocracy, and was a great, was an extremely wealthy man. But two of his sisters married 2 members of the Holy Club. And through them, Selina became acquainted with these people. And one time when she had a period of illness, she thought and meditated on Christian things a great deal, and she came to take a very strong stand with these preachers who were going about England and preaching and reaching the poor people everywhere and gathering them into meetings to develop their spiritual life. And Selina heard one time when Whitfield returned to England and asked him to come and see her and talk with him, and she was very much in agreement with his doctrine and very much impressed with his attitudes. And some of her family tried to remonstrate with her, and they got the Bishop of Gloucester to come and see her, tell her she shouldn't have anything to do with these people. And she was, by this time, well-founded in the Scripture, and she argued with the bishop very strongly, and she said to he said to her, finally he was disgusted, he said, the worst thing I ever did in my life was to ordain George Whitfield. And she said, Bishop, she said, on your deathbed, you will recognize that one of the best things you ever did in your life was to ordained George Whitfield, and actually he did. And on his deathbed, he sent words of remembrance and a gift of money to George Whitfield. But Selina, the Countess of Huntington, took a tremendous interest in Whitfield and his work, and in time she built 40 chapels in different parts of England. And she gathered the aristocracy of England in her great homes and got Whitfield to come and preach to them. And through her, he received an entree to the leaders of English society, many of whom came to know the Lord through his work, as she made this entree for him. One time, Lord Chesterfield, one of the leading nobles of England, a very sophisticated man, was in the group, and Whitfield was preaching to them, and he described the man, a blind man near the edge of a cliff walking along, and how near he was to the cliff and the danger of falling over. And as he described it, the very sophisticated Chesterfield jumped to his feet and said, "Oh, Whitfield, save him, he's going to fall over." He got so tremendously carried away with the presentation. Well, we'll continue there tomorrow morning.